Well, I find these, the series, any series that we're involved in, this is session number 42, kind of like an assembly line. I'm kind of a mechanical guy, so I think about putting cars together on the assembly line. You know, you got to build the engine, and it's built over here. And then you have the, what else do you build? Any parts. The frame built over here, the body shop's doing it over here, you know, and you got all these parts, and somehow they all magically appear at the right time in the right color and the right size for the right piece of equipment with the right accessories on the assembly line, and it comes out a rolling vehicle. I hope my product is not, I wish it was that nice, but I feel we always have to stop and do these parts. You know, we never can get moving on the assembly line. We always got to stop and do parts. So that is a little bit what we have now, although the part is kind of the frame on which everything sits. So the analogy probably is not too bad. Most of you pretty well come regularly. For you that are kind of new, hope this doesn't discourage you because you're jumping in the middle. Like I say, we're less than 42. And maybe it'll make sense. So I'll put on the board kind of where we are. The neo or new evangelicals actually were formed about 1950-ish. Didn't really get its name till 1957. And it is a response to the modernists, we call them liberal, fundamentalists, we call them evangelicals, fight that went on actually from about 1850. And it got hot in the early 20th centuries, ended up in the Scopes Monkey Trial, kind of is a iconic end of it. And we had the fundamentalists go their way, and the modernists go their way, the fundamentalists go their way, and the fundamentalists do really well. I mean, we look at it as probably the best time, I can't say about the early church, it wasn't there. What we have is just the scriptures. But in modern times, there wasn't anything better than those, 50 years, 1900 to 1950, for evangelicalism and the spread of the gospel in the United States and across the world, because so many missionaries went forth to all parts of the world in those 50 years. But for some, it wasn't good enough. And that's where you have the new evangelicals come in. They want to correct this fantastic period of success with success as they saw it, because they saw it as a failure. Their objective was probably more grandiose. They were thinking of reaching the United States like with the Great Awakening, like the whole country would be saved for Christ or saved for Christianity. And that's a pretty big idea. I mean, we think about our little city here, and I remember back in the 80s, we came up with this little program we called Mission Imperative, and the objective was to reach our city. And that ends up being quite a task, too, and we still haven't got it done. So when Achan Gates said he wanted to win America for Christianity, that was an ambitious project. And so they started on it with some tweaking. And so that's kind of where we are with the discussions. These ideas are being formed in the late 1940s, although they aren't necessarily new. And we have the ideas, and then we also have the men that are going to come and carry the water for this. And I thought we'd get to the men that are going to carry this water for them tonight, but we're just going to start that because we just don't have time to get into it. As I said, I'm fixing or building a part over here, and it's on the assembly line, but it takes a while to get this built. So we want to talk about the part that's going to go on this line that we're going to need as we go down the line. All right, building our imaginary historic car. So we are in the seventh week, this is sort of after the new year, the seventh week of our investigation of the 20th century fundamentalist modernist controversy, which I just sort of gave to you. Now, we are going to concentrate on the fundamentalist or the evangelical aspect of this. We're going to pretty well give up on mainline denomination because it no longer plays a significant role having distorted the gospel beyond recognition. So it doesn't mean it's not going to come up. But in terms of what we want to follow now is what we call fundamentalism or evangelicalism, and it's going to be divided. Right, so we're going to forget about the modernists because they're kind of gone. Now, there is a whimper of dead life, oxymoron, in the neo-Orthodox movement after the collapse of classic liberalism and post-millennialism. Now, what is classical liberalism? Well, classical liberalism in Christianity is Christianity without the death, burial, and resurrection of Christ, a Christianity without the saving power of the gospel. And in a sense, when you have that out of it, what do you have left? Well, there's nothing left that's inspirational. There's nothing that's transcendent, we might say, something other than us. So there's nothing inspirational left but the Christian carcass, not even a hint of the divine or the transcendent. The carcass is now doubly dead in the post-millennial hope, in that the whole post-millennial hope centered on improving the unjust and immoral world has been dashed to pieces due to the two brutal wars, World War I and World War II. Post-millennialism just simply died. So we have this carcass of Christianity. So it gets resurrected, but not as a biblical variety, but one that keeps Christian ideas and ideals, retains the words of the death, burial, and resurrection, and even the person of Christ, but assigns to them somewhat mystical terms, says mystical meanings to them, and somehow we say, poof, we have Christianity back. We call it neo-orthodoxy. Now we have neo-evangelicalism. That's different than neo-orthodoxy, although there is some mating going on later on. Neo-orthodoxy factors in later with the theological training of Daniel Fuller, the son of Charles. And neo-orthodoxy factors in our lesson tangentially because of Harvard's theology, their seminary. Their theology is still bound to the classical liberalism. And because of that, it's losing students to Europe, where neo-orthodoxy, like under Barth, is taking students from America and they're going to Switzerland. So this makes Harvard and the other Boston theological school there open to accepting fundamentalist students. Then, as we will see, Harvard will influence these fundamentalists to the destruction of evangelicalism. Now, that's the lesson. That's the lesson. I mean, this whole package, that's the lesson. Harvard is the poison pill. And evangelicals going there and being corrupted by the Harvard School is what destroyed. Well, maybe it's not the only thing that destroyed, but couldn't have been done without them, which is somewhat our lesson today and next time. So neo-orthodoxy is what you'll, now some of you might not be here on Sunday. You might go to your, I don't know where you want to go, to another church that's liberal, and you might happen to be in a liberal church Sunday on Easter. And I would say 99% of what you're going to hear there will no doubt be neo-orthodoxy. It is what you will hear in mainline churches today. They will talk about the death, burial, and resurrection, especially on Easter. They might even refer to the person Jesus and made into something ideal, not associated with the payment for sin and God's satisfaction in it all. It'll be about Christ somehow, but this issue that we call the sacrificial death of Christ on our behalf, that aspect, if it's there, it's only alluded to as somehow of an ideal. So creative genius can make this work for believers. It usually doesn't, and they find these vacancies. You probably won't hear classical liberalism anymore, and you never did really hear it preached, because you can't preach to an audience and hold up the Bible and say, this is a lie. You're not going to hear that, but you will hear something else. You'll hear things like, we're not sure about who the authors are. We don't know when it was written. We don't know for sure how the audience understood this, and there are probably more than one writer. And we have all this culture involved. We don't know for sure how to take it because that was then and it was now. So with the intention of the author or the receiver of the literature, we're all confused about that, and we have language problems, and then we, of all things, we have transmission problems. We don't know, frankly, we don't know what we have here. I'm talking about classical liberalism. And so what do you do with that? Well, I guess it's no help at all. And you just, it's rendered unreliable. See, it's attacked, but not directly. That's classical liberalism. So we ended last week on our next section, which we're easing up to. Our next section will deal with a happenstance that will bring about forming the leadership of the neo-evangelicals. One figure, this is really ironic to me, not in the days of texting or even long-distance flights. One figure in the north, far northeast, Boston, Massachusetts, the other figure in the far southwestern corner of the California coast. I mean, these two guys are far apart geographically, but they are going to be brought together. So dealing with New England, Harold Akingay, a Park Street pastor in Boston, Massachusetts. We had this last week, I think. It is likely that Carl McIntyre and Harold Akingay would agree on the gospel and the objective of winning America. They both taught the gospel. The disagreement was how to win the culture wars of America for Christianity. When Akingay aspired to win America, it was not a newly concocted objective. It was the objective of the modernists. I'm not sure how they intended, but go on. The Roman Catholics, of course, are always on the make. And then the secularists would like to kill all this religious stuff. Now, the difference was just that he had the audacity to suggest that the fundamentalists could win that prize of all America. Now, we're Calvinists in this church, and we know that's not possible. You know, it's always the remnant that gets won. So to think about going to reach the country is sort of, beyond our pay grade. But not necessarily Akingay. Yes, there were claims by the surging Catholics, and they stood a good chance of winning America, but they're still being outnumbered. They're coming in as immigrants. And the mainline Protestant had lost the glittering hope of a post-millennial victory. Remember, two wars. And classical liberalism was dying. So the fundamentalists had some finer adjustments, ought to be able to win America, so thinks Akingay. And I say minor adjustments, and I'm not sure what that means. Maybe just say adjustments. Boston, Massachusetts, revisiting the territory of the Puritans. Let's go back to our early lesson, lesson number one. No, not yet. Not yet. I got ahead of myself here. But 100 miles west of Boston, we must remember that the ministry of Jonathan Edwards of Northampton, Massachusetts, leading theologians of Boston were challenging Christian orthodoxy, which means Trinitarianism. And they're heading for Unitarianism then already. Boston was the territory of the Puritans. They came in mass to the colonies after 1630. The Connecticut River, which flows north and south, formed the frontier of the nascent British colonial America. That was sort of the frontier in 1725. We observed the discombobulation of the Puritans and their failure to convert the next generation, resorting to the halfway measures and then to the full open communion by Solomon Stoddard. Remember that? That'd be lesson 3 and 4. I'm listening to them again, see if they're still okay. So the last time we looked at Boston, it was heading in the wrong direction. Today, it is washed over by universal Unitarianism. It's amazing how many churches you go by, and they're all universal Unitarianism. And they're proud of it. So in our developing study of the fundamentalist, it is uncanny that in a post-World War II Boston, we find a significant conservative fundamentalist church. Park Street was formed in 1804. Building was built in 1810. And it's next to the Boston Commons. The church became known as the Brimstone Corner in part because of the fervent missionary character of its preaching and in part because of the storage of gunpowder during the War of 1812. Park Street Church has a strong tradition of missions, evangelical doctrine, an application of Scripture to social issues, as well as a notable list of firsts. In 1826, Edward Beecher, son of Lyman, brother of Henry Ward Beecher, son of Lyman Beecher, who's an evangelical, a notable abolitionist, became a pastor of this church. Remember, Henry Beecher Stowe was the author of Uncle Tom's Cabin. The church hosted the debut of the song, My Country Tis of Thee, we know it as America, written by Samuel Smith and performed on July 4, 1831. We've got a significant church here. In 1857 to 58, we have evangelist Charles Finney of his revival ilk, whatever that was, led revival at Park Street, which led the pastor Andrew Letty Stone to experience a spiritual awakening, whatever that means. Gleason Archer, now that's in our time, a prominent inerrantist, means he believes the Bible is without error. Theologian was the assistant pastor at Park Street from 1945 to 1948. Gets us right into our time. And his father, Gleason Archer Sr., founded Suffolk University. I didn't look that up. Anybody know where that school is? You're as brilliant as I am. I didn't look that one up. We're not done. Park Street Church still. In 1945, Billy Graham's first transcontinental mid-century crusade began at Park Street. Here you have Billy Graham preaching in 1950 in the Boston Commons. Well, Harold Akinge, notable theologian and co-architect of the neo-evangelical movement, was the senior pastor from 36 to 69, that is 33 years. And during this time, co-founded Gordon Conwell Theological Seminary, still going, south northeast of Boston, about 27 miles. Billy Graham, with him, he founded Fuller Theological Seminary, which is our history we're going to study. He had already formed the National Association of Evangelicals. He formed the War Relief, which later became World Relief, and was instrumental in starting the publication of Christianity Today, which is still circulating. Off of Wikipedia, so whatever they're worth, the church still holds to its doctrinal statement, adopted by the church in 1877 and readopted in 2003. After 200 years, the church is still engaged in current social issues. So social issues always comes up when we talk about this church. They're an evangelical church. And I would venture out to say, in the old definition of things, a dispensational church, at least a premillennial church. Back in Boston, remember? In June 1, 1660, Mary Dyer was hung by the Puritans for not denying her Quaker faith. Some believe it happened in the commons where the church is, but it may have also happened in the common land near the harbor, thus the possible confusion. It matters little where. Executions were possible because of how the Puritans saw themselves in the New Israel. They passed laws in keeping with the Old Testament that forbid any heresy in the colony. I bring this up because if I give you one underlying theme of these 42 lessons, which will stretch into 60 probably, is what happens when you take up the covenantal view of Scripture. When you see yourself as the new Israel and you adopt the Old Testament law for your operation of your church, you'll end up with Mary Dyer being hung. And so the error of that has not been corrected through all these years. The dispensationalists, wherever they were, corrected it. But we're going to find that in this socialized, or this concern for social issues, has crept back into an evangelical dispensational church, and it'll be to its destruction, or destruction of the movement. So that covenant stuff underlies all of this as a negative. Okay, so executions were possible because of how the Puritans saw themselves as the new Israel. They passed laws in keeping with the Old Testament and forbid heresy in the colony. There were only a few, maybe four, of these kind of executions, but not counting witch trials. Then there were dozens. So the surprise is not that there were any executed at all, but there were only four met death this way. That's what the surprise was. Eventually, civility overrode their romanticized Mosaic law. When I say romanticized, they really didn't keep the law. They put it up, so we keep the law, and then did what they wanted to do. So there's the commons on the red dot. On the right is where the church is. Back to the 20th century Boston. So here we are again back in Boston, an unlikely place for anything fundamentalistic. Remember that the greater success of the fundamentalists was in the West or west of the East, the Midwest, the Great Plains states, even we go as far as California. Yet where else could a compromise occur than a place that has been known for its liberalism after Puritan times? And so we have Boston. So the social gospel, a related subject, and understanding a needs-oriented ministry. And I struggled over this. And if you don't get anything out of this, just chalk it up to my inability to explain things. But there's stuff here that needs to be explained. I'll do the best I can. In some way, we think we understand how it works. And I think I do, but yet there is this deficiency. So when we talk about social, we talk about, you know, bees are social insects, right? Why? They hang around each other. And they kind of do things together. They sleep together, eat together, they find pollen together, whatever. They're communists, really what they are. You know, they each contribute their need, the product, and they take what they need, and, you know, everything works fine. So we have these ants, or social insects. So when we talk about social, we're talking about together. We're social as a group, we're social as families, we're social in a community, we're social in our church. In fact, we even have socials in the church, right? We had one last Sunday, I think. It's called a potluck. So when we talk about social, we're just not talking about anything fancy except just relationship stuff. So as people relate to each other, humans in a community, that's social. And so this word, you know, gets battered around. And it has to have a context wherever we use it. But this is a huge topic because it gets, anytime you get into something that's not in the Bible, it gets to be a huge topic because it gets in the political realm. So this topic needs an extended time for study, which, you know, it's like stopping the assembly line and going and do this for 2 weeks, then come back and keep on going. No, I'll do that. I won't do this in one setting and move on. So our subject, the event of the new evangelicals, forces us to look at social issues, and I might say poverty being only one. I mean, how much money you got in the bank or in your pocket or don't have. And how these social issues or needs are defined is already a huge problem. And caveat, and I might say people might think I'm not sensitive. I am sensitive to people who have needs, so I'm not trying to, in anything I say, put down anybody or whatever. I say whatever we say about needs, we have no joy in the misery of want. We have no reason to want it to continue. So it's not like we're trying to do, I'm not trying to do anything. I just want to deal with it objectively. So, but we do want to know what helps, and we want to know what hurts the social condition. Now, a couple of axioms here, basically one. Material, I call material things, or money, this is a money. Allocation for social concern is a red herring for all churches, not just one, all churches. Why? Well, first of all, there's no definition for it, unless you would count the windows and how they're to be cared for. But otherwise, there are no definitions in the Bible. Add to this now, there's no secular objective definition for social needs, which is to say, well, is a social need drinking water? Yeah, probably. Well, how about college education? Some would say yes, wouldn't they? Yeah, they would. So we have this, we don't know what we're talking about. And so we have, this sets up the perfect argument for anything because we don't know what we're talking about. So the church can't get into this because it's a red herring for these reasons already. Second, the church would be bankrupt if the community tapped into the church's treasury. And I've been on staff here for a while, and I noticed how closely the church monitored the money that comes in. You know, it's like pulling teeth getting money out of a church. Well, there's a reason for that. There's not much of it. So the idea that these resources now are available to the community to come in and have would destroy the church, and we would bankrupt before long, unless somehow it was moderated. Then the third thing is gifting is it a help? Actually, gifting is more harmful than helpful. Now, we would know that. In fact, we're going to start a study on Friday morning on this very subject. because there's a lot of confusion about how you really help a person or an individual or a family or a nation or a city. So gifting as a help, giving dollars as a help, is more harmful than helpful, unless we're talking about emergencies, obviously. This can be dealt, but we won't do it here. Fourthly, the church, now here is the big one. The church is incapable of, and in fact, anywhere in society is there something, there's nothing, no one, no organization capable of offsetting the social inequities that are a result of God's worldwide judgments. You know, we would like to, the unbelieving world would like to offset those, like as if they don't exist. They do exist, and they cause trouble. I always say there's four things that God has done. Threw man out of the garden. First of all, cut God man off from relationship with God. Then he threw him out of the garden. That's a problem. Sent him a worldwide flood. That's a problem. And it confuses language. There are four things that we all have to deal with. And to think that we can offset these judgments by some social program, I don't want to say it's laughable because that wouldn't be very nice, but it's laughable. So I asked the question, if they can do that, why can't the church cure cancer? We say, well, I don't have enough money. Well, now you're getting it. Can the church cure social ills? I think the same answer. Again, it's a spiritual issue, not a matter of money. A church can quickly be drained of its resources and fail its mandated mission in the gospel if all the money goes somewhere else. Now, I don't want to be negative here with this or use the wrong image here, but just from biology, in nature, there is a negative model here. The unsuccessful parasite kills the host. So it's possible that something can attach itself to host that could actually kill it. So what good is that then to the... parasite's kind of a bug. We don't like to think about parasite. I don't mean it that way, but just as something attaches to it and lives on it, it will kill it. That doesn't work for the church. Okay, so there will be fundamentalist slippage towards liberalism. It would not likely happen in the West or Midwestern regions. But because of the history of liberalism in New England, it will arrive in an area where leftist social involvement is common in the churches. The fundamentalist churches would be at odds with the liberal churches and under great pressure to conform. And the pressure is, why is your church not involved in helping people? I've heard it, you've heard it. Why does Indian Hills do so-and-so? It's pressure there. Don't say it's not. Well, with the Park Street Church, we have, maybe there's other places, but we can say the first attempt to meld liberalism with fundamentalism. No one else has thought about doing that. You don't want to do that. That's like joining the enemy. So remember, liberalism denies the literal meaning of the Bible and assumes the leftist social causes. I'm going to put leftist social causes here because I have them on the board here, which is humanitarian aid, and the New Israel is the model for them to do that. You know, they have to have a reason why to do this. Israel took care of their own. We're the New Israel. We live in New America. That's the New Israel, and we need to take everybody that's in New Israel. So that's the model. However, fundamentalism affirms the literal meaning of the Bible and thus is unauthorized to take up leftist social causes. It's not in the scripture, so we don't do it. Real social needs are handled personally, and those are usually short-termed and are not a program of the church. You don't have to bring it to the board. You do it on your own. If you want to spend all your money on social things, that's up to you. Maybe you have someone in your family that needs all help that you can give them because of illness or whatever. That's up to you. That's where it should be. So these short-term are, and they're not a program of the church, unless we talk about highly qualified issues for widows and they're highly regulated. You give money to widows that are highly regulated. Well, later, not much later, but now, Carl H.F. Henry will write the booklet entitled The Uneasy Conscience of the Modern Fundamentalist. That reflects this reality. As a Boston Seminary student in the hot environment of liberalism, he is influenced to urge fundamentalists' efforts of social improvement. He said, no, it did not influence me. And my author, I talk about Joel Carpenter in Revive Us Again, says, he didn't say this, I say this, and it's like your kids. You know, you painted the room red. And little Susie comes out with red on her shirt. You've been in the room, Susie, haven't you? No, I'm not in the room. No, I didn't go in the room. So it's almost like Henry here. I wasn't in the room. I didn't get any of that stuff, but the book you wrote shows you did, because it was not the way the fundamentalists write. So where'd you get it? You know, somewhat rubbed off. So it is easy for the fundamentalists to acquire guilt when they ignore the social needs of the community. And for them, think about Henry now, just to compare how the less godly would be in Boston. And they were more interested in the poor than those that are the godly ones. And so it's to their shame. Can you just, it gets pile on you. Now, so the pressure at this point, it takes a cool-headed theology not to accept social work in the church on pragmatic terms. There's no theological basis for it. Don't be argued into it. All right? So in order to discuss real social needs, there must be an understanding of how to provide real help. Talk a little bit about this. The usual option is gifting money because it soothes the guilty conscience. Henry calls it the uneasy conscience. But real help comes from generating your own wealth, from your own work. The Bible gives the simple instruction that if anyone's not willing to work, then he is not to eat. Very simple provision. However, setting that aside, I believe there is another issue that may be larger than the question of helping. While the Obedient Church as an organization may not be actively involved in leftist programs, it does have a societal effect on the community. This is my right-hand column. That right-hand column does have a social effect on our community. The church, in the church assembly, this is how it usually works. In the church assembly, people do not leave how they see things at the door when they enter the church. I don't leave what I believe at the door and come and teach something else. It's me. Same guy walked in the door standing here. So how we see doesn't get left at the church door. So the issue of the gospel and the functioning in the community are explicitly taught, like now, or taught or caught in our conversation. So we just kind of live on this side. We know that we are created to be free. After all, if you have choice, you're supposed to be free. And you have responsibility in the choices that you have in your freedom. It has outcomes. You live with the outcomes of your choices. And generally, you do a good job of that. The outcome is for the best. And you have a productive life. It gains value. And we call that the right side. The right, not the correct side. You know, the right and left are all relative. You know, I think it came out of the French Revolution. The left bank must have been the bad side. And the right one must have been the good side. Anyway, I think that's where the right and left comes, because right and left are not emphatic. It depends on how you use the word. On the left, you have the other. So we talk personal here. On the others, it's the enslaved. They are enslaved. They're victim of others. They're not free. They have to do what they say. The outcome is usually poor. They're on the take rather than on the giving or producing. And they are left with less. All right? So those are the two choices. All right, so this is how we explain stuff. Now, how we as Bible believers have two principles from Scripture that inform us. Now, I've given this, I'll repeat it now. First of all, we are free to make choices and the responsibility for the consequences of these choices. You're all living here under those rules. You drive so fast and not any faster, because if you go faster, it's called dangerous and you might not get here. You'll make a choice, right? Because the outcome might not be good if you go 70 miles an hour on 84th Street. Now, these choices and responsibilities and outcomes are traceable to the test that Adam enjoyed in the Garden of Eden, where God said to him, "Do not, or else I will now choose." That system is how we live, all right? And when we're done with that, we do the right choices, we'll have the bottom of something of value. On the other side, you know, well, it just doesn't fit. It just doesn't work at all. So these pair of duties become the foundation for living free and responsibly. Now, without thinking too much about it, these conviction of responsible choice puts us squarely in what is called a societal conservative, I call it here the right side. That is my responsible choice, a series of personally made responsible choices leads us to the best outcome. And by the way, it has nothing to do with the gospel. We're not talking about the gospel here. We don't want to confuse this with the gospel. This is just how we should function And anyone can participate in this order of living because it's how God made us. So we have Carl Henry's book, The Uneasy Conscience of the Modern Fundamentalist, published in 1947. We mentioned that. And Harold Ockengay writes the introduction. And this is stuff hard to read. This is why I just want to leave it out, but I got to put it in here. So this is how he introduces the book, that the fundamentalists have an uneasy conscience because they should be involved in social. They should be on the left side. They should get on the left side. Recently, when preaching a sermon, Ockengay says, on the influence of the church in a labor crisis, see the social subject here? I invoked a comment from a Christian soldier, said he. I became a political liberal on my knees, though I am a fundamentalist in faith. Why must the church be on the wrong side of every social issue, he asks. So he perceives that we're on the right side, and he wants, Ockengay is saying, Henry is suggesting we should be on the left side. He goes on, if the Bible-believing Christians, the Bible-believing Christian is on the wrong side of the societal problems, which would be the right side. The wrong side is the right side. You know, he's arguing for the other side. I'm arguing for the wrong side. So he's arguing for the right side, that's the wrong side. The right side's the wrong side. If the Bible-believing Christians is on the wrong side of societal problems, such as war, race, class, labor, liquor, imperialism, it is time to get over the fence to the, well, he said the right side, but it actually means the left side. The proper side would be the left side. And he finishes up by saying the church needs progressive fundamentalism with his social message. He says we need to adopt what's on the left side. We've been too much on the right side. So I changed that one word, make it left. I'm going to skip this. It's too much to go through it. He writes the same argument through these little panels. So the wrong side of the issue. He says the fundamentalists are on the wrong side of the issue. We're on the right side of the issue over here. We should be on the left side of the issue. I said, no, that's going to make it worse. It's going to make it worse. But no, he's going to make it better. Okay, while the fundamentalists have been accused of being disengaged in social matters, the truth is that they have been involved in social matters up to their necks because we preach responsible choice. See, I put social concerns on both sides because I'm a social person living in society. You tell me what I need to do to be a productive society member, that's a social issue. So they're all social concerns. So they say we're not involved in social things. We are too. We're teaching people how to live responsibly. That's a social issue because it affects societal health. Well, the fundamentalists have been accused of being disengaged in social matters. The truth is that they have been involved in social matters up to the next, preaching responsible choices. The problem or criticism of the left is not their or our lack of involvement, but our involvement on the wrong side of the issues. They want us to be on the left side of the fence, not on the right side. Fundamentalists have always been on the right side. They just want us to switch sides. So we go to the bottom. This reveals a real problem. It is not that the fundamentalists were not engaged in society, it is that they were on the wrong side, according to them. So fundamentalism teaches personal responsibility and salvation and sanctification. You are responsible for your own life. This produces a free, responsible, productive, self-sufficient, social person. And it affects society. Liberalism makes no judgment about poor choices and its consequences. It only shows interest in the socially fallen, assisting them without any real solutions, which produces a dependent people. Slavery on the left. I always think about how to help. I was thinking about the stewardess says, and she goes through this thing, if there's a change in cabin pressure, make sure you put on the mask on you first and then on your child. Well, that's the principle. You got to deal with yourself if you have that responsibility. And then as you have the time and the energy, then you do something else extra, which is perfectly wonderful. Again, we're not talking about the church doing this necessarily. Another little humble story here. When a child stumbles and falls, we say, look. We say to the child, look where you're walking. I can hear myself saying it right now. By teaching and demonstrating freedom and responsibility, he soon will be walking safely on his own. But when the child stumbles and never learns to look where he is walking, parents must always pick him up. He will continue to stumble. Now, the right will criticize the parent for not teaching the child to look where he is walking. The left will criticize the parent for not picking up the child when he falls. So which choice produces personal responsibility and freedom for the child? Obviously, the first. So Akande and Henry want the fundamentalists to change sides. Well, as we enter the next section, with 20 minutes to go, we need to be clear about what is being advocated by the new evangelicals, particularly at this point, Akande. Said as plainly as possible, he thought that mixing the left social concerns, remember, don't ever ask why somebody spit down, just pick him up, never help him stand on his own, that would be imposition. Mixing leftist social concerns with the gospel would be a combination for the best of two worlds to win America. You've got to have a component of social responsibility with the gospel. That's what they're saying. And that makes a neo-evangelical. The social concerns mixed with the gospel. Now, you've been around long enough, you know which one will win, don't you? Social concerns will always trump the gospel because it's so much easier to do. Except you don't really do it. You just do things that make it look like you're doing it. So we're back to Boston again. Okay, we have set up the environment for the perfect fundamentalist storm. Now we must deal with the personalities in the center of it. We underscore the fact that neo-evangelicals, term that started in 1957, so we would 10-year period here where that word wasn't used. Neo-evangelicals did not appear in a dream as such, but came about by the normal processes of good people being in the wrong place who will absorb unwittingly false assumptions. This is one of those crazy things, you know. This is happening in Boston. It didn't happen in Omaha, Nebraska, or Kansas City. It happened in the only place where it probably could have happened was a lot of liberal thinking is going on, and there's some conservative thing going on, and they think, well, this has got to go together somehow. Well, the question is, were the scriptures not known or were they unwittingly ignored? And I'm thinking about the nature of the church. You know, we have that really clear. We've been taught so well here about that. And we didn't always know that clearly before Gill came. So, you know, there's been a growing process for us. So you can imagine that some places in the United States that, you know, what is the church again exactly? And you might want to read widely and find out that everybody understands how this works. So even as premillennials, they maybe didn't quite understand that, and they still thought themselves somewhat as under the law, and they do the things that Israel wanted them to do as the new Israel, because they seem to draw from the idea that the church is the new Israel, because nothing else accounts for the development of these skewed theologies. So we have these five guys, there's more, and this is the book I referred to, I just put it up here because it's my favorite still, Joel Carpenter's Revive Us Again. Twilight has one book. She'll get more. Now we go back to the Park Street Church in Boston. Now, I really believe that Akande was an evangelical. I don't think he was a wolf in sheep's clothing. I really think he was an evangelical. Akande was denied preaching in the commons of Boston. Now, he wanted to preach out in the open. That's pretty, you know, go out to the park and preach. But he's denied preaching in the commons. So he took the innovative step and built some kind of a scaffolding in this church and stood outside his church and preached in the open from his church. Couldn't say much about that. I mean, you know, so it wasn't just some guy that's crawling away and just making a political argument here. He's really trying to reach Boston with gospel. So he called it the Mayflower pulpit. Akande was a true fundamentalist, concerned for the salvation of the lost, alone in the field in spite of the liberal churches around him. He will have Billy Graham come and preach revival in Boston as an early venue for Graham. Those and other actions show clearly Akande was one of the fundamentalist champions. What is important to focus on here is the formation of the impulse to reform fundamentalism, unite like-minded evangelicals, and lead a two-pronged offensive for winning America by means of a renaissance of Orthodox Protestant thought, and another great awakening. He understood this was going to have to be a great movement. Akande was a likely leader for this initiative. He was the pastor, not of some tin roof tabernacle, but of an old distinguished congregational church that overlooked the Boston Common. Akagi had attended Princeton Theological Seminary, apprenticed with the Presbyterian conservative leader, Clarence McCartney, married above his social background, and earned a doctorate in philosophy in the University of Pittsburgh. It would have been relatively easy for Akinge to distance himself from his holiness fundamentalist background and settle into a comfortable career within the Protestant mainline. But beneath Akinge's cool cerebral demeanor was an ardently evangelical heart and ambition to achieve great things for the evangelical cause. Akinge yearned for the evangelical faith to reshape his adopted city and region. He was doing what he could to promote that cause. Akinge and his influential parishioners became valuable supporters of the New England Fellowship efforts, notably by helping to organize Charles Fuller's radio rallies in 1939 and 1941 in the city's largest arena. So we have the first mention here of Charles Fuller. Akinge was eager to retain full measure of public respect for the gospel. He believed that it would take nothing less than a great awakening sweeping over the region like that under Jonathan Edwards and George Whitefield 200 years before. So profound was his spiritual and emotional struggle over this matter that at one point he has reported he actually lost his preaching voice. Akinge became convinced that an evangelical revival with cultural victories following would not come without reformation. The old school fundamentalism could not win America, and I was wondering whether he's reflecting back on the days of the trial. What was needed, Akinge insisted, was a progressive fundamentalism with an ethical message. Well, this is what I think. Fundamentalism going down the road, and Akinge is steering into oncoming traffic. Not a good thing. Progressive is never good. Progressivism leaves you to slavery. So remember, these are the 3 points. Don't have them on the board. I was going to write them up, didn't. Okay. 3 objectives of new evangelicalism. Sensitive concern for the ethical needs of the world around you. The need for fundamentalists to step up to the academic challenge and regain the territory lost to the liberal scholars. And I think there's probably a thought here. If you go back in the early science movement, those guys that were the great thinkers were Christians, at least Christians in their embrace of theology. So I think they'd like to regain that because the liberalism stole it from them again. So maybe they thought that that was really their territory. And then reform fundamentalism to be more inclusive, less separate, and establish an opportunity to influence a liberal point of view so we can dialogue and, you know, we can influence the liberals. Remember, the liberal church, I have sort of written them off. They haven't yet. So they needed people to carry this forward, somebody to carry the water, a project that needed to be developed on the fly. This is not a time that was laid out. It was sort of like this happens and this happens and this happens, as we will see. Okay, another of Akinge's concern, one of those 3 I have up there, was being echoed by the scholarly Wilbur M. Smith of Moody Bible Institute. Maybe some of you have his books. Smith had just published a hefty treatise, Therefore Stand, a plea for a vigorous apologetic in the present crisis of evangelical Christianity, 1945, in which he argued that it was the church's business to influence the nation's intellectual life. Now, Wilbur Smith definitely an inerrantist and a dispensationalist. For fundamentalists, this was a rare thought, this regaining this intellectual ground. However, and Smith sensed that it would take a whole new group of conservative Christian scholars to mount the vigorous apologetic he envisioned. He didn't see it in the schools that he came from. Smith could not have known that very soon he would find himself in such a company. For the idea of mounting a more positive intellectual cultural witness was growing among some younger fundamentalists. Indeed, Harold Akinge recently had discovered that a group of younger theologians were living virtually in his backyard. This is a key issue right now. He's going to find people that are going to help him do this, exactly what he needs in his front yard, backyard, whatever. They had come to Harvard, which is in Boston, Divinity School. These are fundamentalist guys in a liberal school, unheard of. They came to Harvard Divinity School, or in case of 2 of them, Boston University, school of theology, both liberal schools. They learned their trade and earned their credentials as theologians. During the mid to late 1940s, there were more than a dozen evangelical Protestants earning doctorates at Harvard. Three from the Wesleyan Holiness Movement, Asbury College and Seminary, two from the Churches of Christ, one who was a Pentecostal, 11 from fundamentalist backgrounds. Among the fundamentalists were Samuel Schultz, Kenneth Cancer, some of these guys you might not know. I knew some of them. I don't know them all. Both of whom would go on to teach at Wheaton College, where Merle Tenney was, had preceded them from Harvard a few years ago. John Gerstner, who used to have his books, would become the church historian at Pittsburgh Theological Seminary. Burton Goddard, Roger Nicol, and other who had begun what would turn into long careers at Gordon Divinity School. Terrell Crum and of the Providence Bible Institute, and five who would join the faculty at Fuller Theological Seminary, Edward John Carnell, Gleason Archer, Elton J. Ladd, or George Elton Ladd, and Paul King Jewett, and Glenn Baker. These names will become more familiar. So here are the founding factors of faculty. I think these are all of them. We have Ockengay on the left, and we have Wilbur Smith. Then we have Carl Henry, and then we have Harold Lindzel. We have not talked about him yet. He'll be a major player later than Everett Harrison. And they are on the ground of Fuller. Now, Carnell also enrolled in the doctoral program in theology at Boston University, where he was joined for several summers by Carl Henry, a fellow Wheaton graduate who was on the faculty of North Baptist Theological Seminary. These are high-ranking schools, high-ranking intellects. I'm going to skip this till next time. But what this is explains from the dean of Harvard, Dean Sperry, see his name the second line down, explains how these fundamentalist guys showed up at his school and how they're faring. Because it was unusual, you know? It was unusual that they were there. It tempts me to go into a little bit. The reason that they're there is because of liberalism. I said this in my first panel. Liberalism was not popular anymore in America because they were going to Europe to study with Barth as neo-Orthodox, a neo-Orthodox theologian. So these schools were looking for students. So they accepted some of these fundamentalist students they shouldn't have ordinarily accepted. And the bad part of it is when they accepted those students got re-educated. You know, and I think so often when Gill was in Fuller Seminary, when he was in their doctor program, he left them. Remember what he said when he left them? And you remember what he said? What he said, why he left them? If I stay, I'll become like you are. And that's wisdom to do that. I mean, it takes the courage to do that. We'd probably spent $1,000 sending over there on an airplane every week to get this degree. And to walk away from it takes courage. Let me just read through this since I've got 5 minutes. Now, this is, Martin Marty is writing this in Fundamentalism and Evangelicalism, so I don't have a copy of it. It's one of these books online. I screen pasted it. So anyway, so this is what Dean Sperry says. It is not clear exactly how many such students, fundamentalists, were there. Dean Sperry does number a half a dozen in the three regular classes, but is vague about those in upper classes to say nothing about the graduate program. More important, he seems to have some anxiety as to how the Divinity School contingency, the ones that are there, are going to react to this new development. Acknowledging that these men present an academic problem in that they seldom have 4 years of regular college work, which we technically require for admission here. He points out that some of them have come with an AB, is that an associate arts kind of degree? AB, in theology, and whatever the value of that degree, they do have certain qualifications which highly commend them. They already know their way around the major biblical and historical fields, and their store of relevant facts in advance awaiting reinterpretation is much in excess of the ordinary college graduate. So in a sense, they come in a whole, but they also are advantaged. So this is much in excess of what of these ordinary college men do. So they're ahead of most everybody. The experience of these men, he says, has on the whole been encouraging. It was only the beginning. For whatever reasons, fundamentalists kept on applying to Harvard Divinity School. And through the 1940s and 50s, the school kept accepting them, giving them what Dean Sperry called a theological re-education, and sending them out with baccalaureates and graduate degrees. While classification of theological labels is always suspect and especially hard to decipher, in a rearview mirror, the number of self-acknowledged fundamentalists who graduated PhDs from Harvard in the remaining 13 years of Sperry's deanship was at least 12. Two others received their degrees in 1960, most of them their classwork within their earlier times. So what I'm just showing you is these guys are unusual that they're in this school. And that they're in this school will change the course of the neo-evangelicals. And to me, it's really exciting when I read this in Joel Carpenter's book, because I always knew that there was this idea of Fuller and Ockenguy and Billy Graham to start the school. And the next thing that I know in history is they all show up in Pasadena as faculty members. I didn't have this little piece in between here, which is what we just have. So, okay, I got 4 minutes.